hope you can help me," he said, just as he had the day he'd first shown up at my door, and yet this time he spoke in a kind of whisper I had never heard before. He moved his hand to my arm. I was afraid of what he was going to say. "Buzz, it's late." He tried to interrupt me, but now I was setting down the ice bucket, throwing another chunk of ice to my hysterical dog, chattering. "Holland will be back tomorrow. You better run if you want to catch that streetcar." He said he knew Holland would be back tomorrow, and that was the point. He had not come to see Holland. He'd come that night to talk with me.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, author Andrew Sean Greer reads from his acclaimed new novel, The Story of a Marriage. It's set in the 1950s, and it's about a young housewife and the curious love triangle she finds herself in. The story of a marriage is also one shaped by the social events and upheavals of its day: racial desegregation, the aftermath of World War II, and the execution of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Andrew Sean Greer is best known for his breakthrough novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, from 2004. He was born in Washington, D.C. to two scientists, and he returned to his hometown in June 2008 to read from The Story of a Marriage at the Politics and Prose bookstore.
Thank you. I'm going to just read for a little bit, and then I'll answer questions, which will seem silly if you already know me. So if there is a moment when your mind wanders, that is the moment to think of a question to ask me, and I'll call on you, and we'll all know you're the person who wasn't paying attention. But it'll be helpful. Otherwise, there's a weird silence. The setting is, it's 1953 in San Francisco, and it's a woman, Pearlie Cook, looking back on her younger self. So she's in her 70s looking back on her young self in her 20s and her marriage there. I'm going to start a little way into the book. And she is married to a man named Holland, and they have a son named Sonny. And one day a stranger comes, someone who Holland knew in the war, named Buzz, and he sort of insinuates himself into their lives. And we learned that he and Buzz met each other in a hospital after the war when they had both sort of were a little shell-shocked. And I think that's all you need to know. That's all I wrote down here. And if you lose your way, the most important thing is there's a dog named Lyle, so don't think that's a person who's chewing ice. It's a dog. On Saturdays, when Holland worked overtime, Buzz sometimes came early. I didn't mind. He looked after Sonny while I did my chores. It was good to have someone other than the aunts to entertain my son. But there was also something uncomfortable about those times. Buzz would be in the middle of telling me a story, the most banal kind of story, in his bumblebee accent, when he would pause, and I'd just know somehow, even with my back turned, that he was staring at me. I swore to myself I would not turn around. It was almost a game. I wonder what the neighbors thought. I really do. It amused me to imagine they might whisper about Pearlie Cook and her affair with this new visitor. We were out back on an unusually bright, hot Saturday, pinning clothes to the line, and he was handing the damp, bleach-smelling things to me as I fought to hold them firm against the wind. The white sheets cracked in the breeze with the sound of a great fire. That was when Buzz asked me if I had a sleeping problem. "No," I said, "it's Holland." Poor man. Holland and I kept two bedrooms connected by a little hallway. Lyle slept in my room on a sheepskin. That's a dog. Holland slept alone. My husband was a delicate sleeper, as he was delicate in all things, and it had long ago been decided that he'd have his own room. I think I was the one who insisted on it. "Had it ever since the war," I said. "He can't fall asleep if there's any sound at all. Dogs in the yard at night, that's the worst. And anybody else in the room. Even so, he doesn't sleep most nights." Buzz kept wringing out clothes and holding them for me to pin. I said, "I suppose he slept in the hospital." "Well, we all had different pills to take," he said, smiling. "And you started up your business." "I took over my father's business," Buzz answered. "Holland was my right-hand man, and then I traveled. Quite a bit, in fact." I put two of the wooden pins in my mouth, and talking through them, I asked, "Did you all have a falling out?" He said nothing for a while. Finally, he said, "Well, I got this nose." He has a broken nose. I nodded. "It's a beauty. Thank you. How'd you get it?" "Holland." The sun flashed across the billowing sheets. I blinked, turned towards Buzz, and saw him raising a hand to his face just as the sunlight stained him white all along his arm. Holland hit you? Buzz just cocked his head and watched me. Holland never raised his voice except at the radio, never hit a thing except the couch pillows before he sat down, grinning with his cigarette. But once, of course, he'd been a different man, a man trained to shoot other men during the war, who drank, who sang with soldiers and hit a friend across the nose. At last I asked, was it over a woman? He handed me a pair of trousers, yes. I pulled out the trouser dryer and began to stretch the pants onto it. Tell me. Pearly, he said, we were born at a bad time. I don't know what you mean. It's a fine time. I didn't know what he meant by we. I couldn't imagine what might bind me together with a man like Buzz, as likable as he was. I couldn't draw any kind of line around the two of us. You're proud of your house, he said. You have a nice touch. It belongs to Holland's family. It can't be cheap, he said to me. I mean, Sonny being sick and all. Holland's aunts help out, I said. With the bills, the braces, it is a lot. Of course, it's no trouble, I added hastily. Now, what would you do if you had all the money you needed? I had no answer to that. It was a thoughtless question to ask a poor woman with a sick son, something only a rich man would ask, like wondering aloud to a freshly broken-hearted girl, what if it turns out he loved you after all? It was something I had never allowed myself to think about. What would I have done? I'd have moved my family away from a house like that, with glaring neighbors and stains on the basement walls from the ocean creeping in, with crickets sifting in out of the door sills with the sand, to Egypt, to Mali, to some fantasy destination I only knew from books. My God, I'd have flown to Mars with Holland and Sonny and never come back. That was the only answer I could think of. A woman like me, I couldn't afford to name my real desires. I couldn't even afford to know them. All I said was, I've got everything I need. I'm happy. I know, but just imagine, where would you live? This house is better than anything my parents had. But just say, an apartment high above a city, a cliff over an ocean with a view all around, 500 acres with a fence all around. What would I do with 500 acres? I said without thinking. And then he looked right at me, not a shy man at all. And I think for a moment I understood. I stood there staring at him with the metal dryer contraption in my hand and the damp trousers over my arm. The sun came in full and lit the world from top to bottom. You could almost hear the jasmine reaching up for it. And then we heard the sound of Holland's car returning, and Buzz turned away. In a moment, Holland shouted, "Hey there!" from the house. I heard a bicycle bell and Sonny heading down the hall. And Buzz said nothing else, touching his nose as if touching the memory of pain. He was half to the sun, and the shadow of his ruined hand fell across his long face in the form of another younger hand cradling his cheek. The wind burrowed into his hair like a living creature. I didn't say a word to him as he went inside, just continued stretching the trousers in the sun to dry. And down I went, into the green deep, flecked with gold and draped with waving plants, endless, bottomless, and forgot what I had glimpsed. I was a careful woman, a good gardener, and I pruned away the doubt. But you know the heart. Every night it grows a thorn. It happened when Holland left town. He was a traveling inspector for a fittings company, his area covering all of Northern California, and sometimes he had to stay the night in Redding or Wairika, by the misty sea or the misty mountains, in hotels named the Thunderbird or the Wigwam. Of course, he didn't call. Long distance in those days was only used when someone had died or when you decided to tell someone too late that you loved them after all. My neighbor Edith Furstenberg, her mother, had come to visit before supper, wearing her new Aqua 7-way blouse from Macy's. Only 3 ways, really, if you think about it. She wanted to gossip about the Shang family who had been excluded from Southwood by community vote, and how ashamed she was of our town, how ashamed after all the Chinese had suffered. It's hard for the color, too, I said. But not here in San Francisco, she said. Not here in the sunset, thank God. We tried out her blouse in all 7 ways, none of them appealing. Don't ever change, she shouted at me in that fashionable phrase from some television show I'd never seen. I washed some delicates in something she'd loaned me called Re-Clean, so safe you can smoke while using it. And then Sonny and I were left alone with Sky King on the radio, and for half an hour my son stared into the carved wood lyre of its mouth, surely understanding nothing but that he loved it. He fell asleep in my lap and I put him to bed. It had been an unseasonably hot day, followed by a humid night. Just before sunset it had briefly rained, and the last of the warm sun turned the air to steam that shimmered down to the ocean. The German and Irish families were out grilling, walking the streets, standing at corners and laughing as the men threw cans of beer to one another, and the children wrestled in the still wet grass. It was so delightfully warm that I opened the drapes and windows, but unsettled by the idea of neighbors peering in, I turned out all the lights and sat in the kitchen, satisfied, water in the kettle, Lyle at my feet. It's a dog. People have been confused. The singing kettle filled the air with noise for some time before I reached it. The stove's red eye was all that lit the room. I took the kettle off the flame, and as it calmed and fell to silence, I heard the knocking that must have begun while the kettle was sounding its alarm, a tapping at the window pane. I turned, and I was reminded of an image that always haunted me. After the war, I'd heard that Berliners replaced their blown-out window glass with doctor's x-rays. Before my eyes adjusted, all I saw was a broad white hand spread on a black window pane. "Buzz," I said, unlatching the door. His eyes looked around the dim kitchen. "Would no one answer the front door? I thought you might be having an affair." He laughed. He was in a dark suit and a dark shiny tie, and when he stepped over the door sill, he removed his hat, as always. And then he said, "Pearly, what are you doing alone in the dark?" "Don't," I said quickly, because his hand was reaching for the switch. I found that I put my hand on his. It was as smooth as touching a glove. He didn't ask why. He merely stood there, handsome Buzz, with a hat in his hand. He looked like he wanted to sell me something. I laughed, which caused a baffled smile to flicker on his face. "Is Holland around?" "He's out of town," I said, "and Sonny's sleeping." "Oh, of course," he said, shaking his head. "I forgot he's traveling. How stupid of me. And selfish." "No, no. He's up in Wairika, right? So I'm wrecking your night alone." A wry smile. "Not at all," I said. "Wairika Bakery," he murmured to himself, smiling. "What's that?" "Oh, it's a silly joke. It's a mirror name. You can read it backwards and forwards. Wairika Bakery. I wonder if there really is a bakery there." I laughed. "I never heard of that. I have to tell Holland." "Too hot to hoot," he said. "That's another." I said that was a good one. "Oh, it's just foolishness." And once again, we were alone in my silent house. "You came all this way," I said at last. "Want some tea, or no, maybe a whiskey? I feel like a whiskey, don't you?" "I could hardly turn one down," he said, with a kind of relief. I poured out 2 glasses, and we both downed them in a second. That was how you did it in those days. I poured us another round and went to the freezer to get the ice. Lyle jumped around beneath me, hoping to get a piece. For some unknown reason, his silence came with a love of chewing ice. "What a strange warm night," I said. "Ain't it? Too hot to hoot." I opened the freezer, a lion's roar, pulled out the ice tray, sliding the little metal levers and releasing the ice into a bucket. I threw one into the air, and Lyle caught it like a dolphin. Loudly, he began to crack the cold little thing with delight. "Here's to spring in San Francisco," I said. "You never know." I toasted him, and again we drank. I said, "Holland tells me you still live in a bachelor apartment with 1 burner on the stove. Why don't you move somewhere better?" "Well, I went away traveling. I left it empty for a few years. Never got to improve it, and I have a sentimental attachment to that burner, I'll have you know." "Any family around?" He looked into his drink as if the answer were at the bottom. "No, there's nobody around. My father died last year." "I'm sorry to hear that." and my mother's been gone a long time now," he said, smiling sadly and taking another sip. "I was surprised to have to take over the business out here. It wasn't something I'd ever planned on. I'm not the business type." "What had you planned on?" A shrug, a nervous look at the door. "That's what I traveled to discover."
"Did you discover it?"
He nodded. We downed our drinks again. I reached for the cigarettes and he put his hand on mine. Neither of us moved. Pearly. He was so different. After two or three bolts of whiskey, he'd stopped playing the affable golden boy. He seemed 1,000 years old with the lights from the houses cutting him clean in half and deepening the sun lines in his face. The darkness drained everything of color, and so his bright blonde hair had gone stark white. With his hand on mine, I could feel his heart racing. "I hope you can help me," he said, just as he had the day he'd first shown up at my door. And yet this time he spoke in a kind of whisper I had never heard before. He moved his hand to my arm. I was afraid of what he was going to say. "Buzz, it's late." He tried to interrupt me, but now I was setting down the ice bucket, throwing another chunk of ice to my hysterical dog, chattering. "Holland will be back tomorrow. You better run if you want to catch that streetcar." He said he knew Holland would be back tomorrow, and that was the point. He had not come to see Holland. He'd come that night to talk with me. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what I wanted to happen. His touch suddenly felt very warm on my arm. "Listen to me," he said. "I have to tell you something." "Buzz, I think," but his voice stopped me, and his hand moved to my shoulder. "Pearly, listen to me. Please listen to me." Something in me shifted. It was as if an alarm had sounded. Here was a plain, pale face stained with longing, and in that darkness he looked nothing like the man I'd known for weeks, the confident old friend. I stood quiet and still, pressed against the wall. And then he told me, with a soft country voice in his eyes, gazing at a photograph on the wall. A careful man touching my arm. I think he had never talked of love before. For you see, he had not come all that way on the streetcar for Holland. He had come for me, Pearly Cook. He had pieced that speech together over the years, practiced it over and over in his bachelor's rooms downtown, a prisoner building a palace out of toothpicks. Carefully, slowly, he gave me a masterpiece only a lonely man can make. And when he was done, he let go of my arm. He took a step away from me back into the shadow. I could hear Lyle cracking his ice like a nut. A tinker on his way back from his rounds broke out in song, "Grind your scissors, grind your knives." I stood with my cheek flat against the wall, looking out at our neighborhood and the shapes I knew so well, the light rim borders of my world. I think I'll stop there. A moment of tension. And now those of you who weren't paying attention get rewarded. If anyone have any questions.
In this book and Tivoli, you do masterful evocations of other eras. Do you do conscious research? Do you do a lot of reading about these eras? And if you do, when do you know you've got enough and are ready to go?
That's a good question. Well, you know, they were completely different kinds of research for me. I was surprised. For Max Tivoli, I could get away with books about the Victorian era and costumes and that kind of thing, or even real cheater books that are called, like, A Writer's Guide to Victorian America, you know, for romance writers. But, you know, it was true. I mean, they don't have that for the 50s, I'm sad to report. But they did have something else in the 50s, which was they had better newspapers, because in the 19th century, the newspapers are cattle ads and sort of racist organization meeting notes. But in the 50s, so that's what I did, was for this one, I read the newspaper for almost all of 1952 and 1953. I sat there in the library and did the microfiche machine.
The Chronicle?
In the Chronicle, yeah. I read the Chronicle. Yeah. And, well, from February to May, because I switched years. It was originally 52, and I changed it to 53, so I had to start all over. I made a little folder by newspaper stories and food and clothing and objects, and you can see them in here. That Re-Clean cleaner I thought was just hilarious. I mean, the things that people want out of life, to be able to smoke while you clean, you know, it's just insane. And Sky King and those kind of things, stuff like that. But I find I have to remove most of it, because you put it in to prove to yourself you know what you're doing. But to prove to your reader you know what you're doing, you have to remove almost everything so it sounds like you don't think it's a big deal, you know? But I had some trouble with interviewing people. I interviewed people, too, because obviously plenty of people remember 1953. But, like, I talked to my mom, who was too young at the time. No. But she did say what a lot of people said, and you know, in her age group, which would be, she would say, oh, yeah, the 50s, it was Elvis and poodle skirts, and just that's completely wrong. So it's way later. Yeah, it's 59. So she was useless. And you did catch me on the dishwasher, which I had to change a little bit. And there was an ironing machine that came and went. I couldn't decide if they would own one across the Furstenbergs own an ironing machine. Well, these Furstenbergs do. But I found a wonderful woman, an Armenian woman who lived in the Sunset District of San Francisco. She's in her 80s, and she knew the area perfectly well. And so I had her look over the book. And there's a tinker that goes around at the end of this. And there's a big part at the beginning of the book that talks about milk delivery and egg delivery and that kind of thing. And she said, that didn't happen in the Sunset. That was the 30s. You've got it all wrong. Just take that out and the book's fine. And I know she's wrong because it's in the newspaper. And so I realized there was a weird thing where it's more like the 30s. It's not as typical of the 50s. 40s, rationing, there wasn't egg delivery and that kind of thing. So she has compartmentalized in her memory that the 50s was a different thing for her. So I had to ignore her advice as well. I could do something better. I had to be specific. I was asking too general a thing. I had to say, how did you get milk delivery? How did you ask for the milk? And she would say, well, there were colored cardboard strips that you left in your bottle, and you left an orange one for orange juice, and you left a couple for cream, and then they would deliver those. And I said, thank you, because that's something I could never know from the newspaper, because why mention it? That's how you order milk. It doesn't come up. So it was a combination of those things, and I'm sure I've got it wrong.
I'd be interested to hear you talk a little bit about what it's like to write from the female character's point of view as a male. How do you prepare for that, and what's that whole process like?
Well, you know, I had, of all absurd things, British Vogue contacted me to write a piece about writing from a woman's point of view, and they wanted 1,800 words. And I wrote back to them, I said, I cannot fill it. I don't know what to say. Because it's the kind of thing that I thought about at the very beginning and never thought about again. You know, I worked for a long time to shed the Max Tivoli voice, which was this sort of overwrought Victorian narcissistic male voice. And so I worked a long time to shed it and to get a different voice. And so at that point, I was so caught up in getting the character right that I never thought about her as a woman, I guess. I mean, it occurred to me that her attachment to her son would be her main motivating factor in making her choices, you know, but that might be true of a man too. I'm not very good at answering the question in a way. But then I was been writing for her for years, so I didn't write anything else as a man. Yeah. I wish the answer were I put on a dress or something. Yeah. But, well, just because I just thought of her as a character, I think if I thought there was a woman's way of writing, that might have seemed like a impersonation or something.
And what about her as an African-American woman?
That was the same thing, too. I thought about that a lot at the beginning because I needed her to be... At first, I wrote the story. I began it with her as a white woman. I had two problems. One was that there wasn't the right restriction on her to stop her from making certain choices. She needed to be isolated. And I felt I was being cowardly reading the newspaper that I wasn't talking about the major issue of the day. I thought, I'm just writing about these white people, and I'm reading the paper. And I realized that it was the same answer, which was that she was trapped in all these kinds of ways because of the time she was born in. And also, the book is about making assumptions about the people you know. And in a way, the reader makes an assumption about, because you don't find out for a little while that it's a black woman. Or you might assume from the beginning. But I think a lot of readers assume that it's going to be a white woman because I'm white. So I, you know, I was curious what readers, how they would react to that when they would look back and that their default narrator is white, whether that would make them question how they are reading books, which is sort of part of the theme of the book as well. How could there be another question after that one?
Do you know a dog who chews ice?
I feel like I do. Don't a bunch of them chew ice? Yeah, I get in trouble because I describe the dog wrong. Apparently, I have the wrong breed or something. People are calling, yeah, it's a Basenji, I guess, but I refer to it as freckled, which they're not, so. Yeah, well, you know, I feel like it's a kind of a strange, in my mind, I thought, well, it's just some mutt that doesn't bark, because I don't know if those were popular at the time in America, you know? I have no idea. Okay, so well, barely would work. All right. And the paperback will change it. All right. But he does like ice? Okay. It'll work out just fine. Help? Okay. It's a subtle change. Oh, maybe that's it. My mom's dog chewed ice. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.